how you doing? Thanks for downloading the show. Welcome to Garden Fork. It's Eric. I have a YouTube channel and this eclectic podcast, if this is your first time here. Thanks for checking it out. I often go to iTunes, looking for interesting podcasts. And some of them are interesting. So a lot of them are very kind of commercial now. And this is the polar opposite of commercial if you're downloading it for the first time. So, and everyone else, hey, we're back. It's an eclectic DIY show, and I have Mr. Eclectic himself, Will, from the YouTube channel Weekend Homestead, sir. Hello.
How are you doing today?
I love it when you email me because you make me do the podcast. You make me pick a time. No, you give a choice of dates and times, and I just have to say yes.
I try to make it easy for you, you know? It doesn't need to be complicated.
This is how you get on the podcast, everyone. Hey, Eric. Wednesday, 9 a.m. your time. Let's talk about this, this, and this. I'm like, okay.
I just bring it all packaged together and just ready to go. So
all I have to do is plug in the microphone and I'm good. So we're going to talk about the latest Garden Fork vids, some equipment talk, egress windows, which I'm very interested in, the apple season, and just kind of fall prep and the Facebook group. So I'm all ears, Will.
I will say that just to start with the Facebook group, if you're not part of the Facebook group, it's an awesome group of people that help. Like, I had an apple issue where I had a ton of apples this year and I needed to get some suggestions. I posted online and I think we got 40 or 50 some comments and suggestions, and all of a sudden we had a whole pile of things that we could do with our apples this year that I hadn't even thought of. And it's just a great community of people helping each other out.
Yeah, one person that comes to mind is Wanda, who is always with a good idea. And so with the apples, people suggested making apple butter, I think.
Yeah, we tried that actually. And wow, that is really good. We made some pork chops and you just put a little bit on the pork chop and it just kind of melts a little in there. And it was super simple to make. I mean, it took maybe a half hour total, but wow, it was amazing.
Are you using the famed Instant Pot for that or something else?
No, we what you do is you just cut up the apples. Have you ever seen one of those apple core slicers? I think you had a video with it in there where you just kind of turn the crank. Everybody thinks that's the craziest device because it makes dealing with apples easy.
Yeah.
But you basically run them through there, throw them in a pot with a bunch of seasonings and let that cook down. Then there's a grinder that you grind the apples through that kind of makes it into applesauce. And then once it's applesauce, then you put it back on the stove, like really slow for like 2.5 hours. And it eventually works all the moisture out of it and it kind of becomes a paste. Once you put it in the jars, do your regular canning and you're good to go.
Apple butter is a really good substitute for jelly on a peanut butter and jelly sandwich because the sugar, first of all, it's a natural sugar, which we could argue about, but it's less sugar than your average jelly or jam preserves from the grocery store has in it. So
yeah, the beauty of it was the recipe that they gave me had no chemicals in it or byproducts or anything like that. It was literally just apples and some different spices and seasonings, and that was it.
The grinder, is that called a food mill? Did you run it through a food mill?
Yeah, somebody told me it was called a Foley mill. We actually had to look online and ended up buying one on Amazon last year. So yeah, I think it's called a Foley mill.
Yeah, it gets the seeds out and the skins out if you need be. But it's a great process. I actually went to, we have an orchard right near us, and I dropped off my first 5-gallon carboy to get fresh cider to make hard cider.
Nice.
Which
nice.
Is the easiest thing. If you're thinking about wanting to learn how to make beer or wine or whiskeys or whatever, hard cider is the easiest thing to start with. It takes longer. I find that leaving it in the bottle for a year is best. But you can drink it after a couple months and it tastes okay, but it seems to, the flavor kind of improves, I think, in the bottle. Bottle conditioning, I think they call it.
Do you have to have a special device or machine to make that happen, or how does that work?
No, I just, you know, those 5-gallon water, those blue water jugs for the water cooler? Invariably, someone is throwing them out, even though they have a deposit on them. At least in New York City, when people are moving, sometimes they just stick them out in the trash because they're like, I don't have time to deal with this. I've seen them upstate as well for sale at yard sales. And you can buy a airlock that snaps on the top of that. Midwest Supplies is a really good homebrew supply company. They're in Minnesota, eh?
Yeah.
And there's like this orange cap, this rubber cap that goes on the top with two fittings can go in there, and you can put an airlock on there. And it's like, I mean, it's probably $11 for the two parts. And then I just, I kill the wild yeast that are present in the cider, because when they press the cider, the skins are mixed in and there is yeast on the skin of the apple, a wild yeast, because I want to control what it tastes like. So I buy a dry champagne yeast, a yeast that gives a dry champagne rather than a sweeter champagne. And I drop that in there and I just let it bubble for like a month, and then I bottle it. And that's it.
That seems really simple.
Yeah, I mean, you have to have some gear, but if you're interested in home brewing, it's not that expensive. I have some episodes about that, and I'll link to those. But also, literally, I've seen twice now in the last year someone wanting to get rid of their beer brewing equipment. They bought a beer kit and they're not interested in it. I've seen them in yard sales. And you only need, you need like a bottle capper, which is kind of a more expensive item. It's maybe $25. And you, it has, it helps have some tubing and some gear, but there isn't a lot needed, and you can make some stuff.
Well, you're braver than I am. We tried it once, and there was a kit called Mr. Beer that I got for Christmas one year or something, or one of the guys did, and we tried it back when we were in college, and oh, it was horrible, the stuff that we made. We just opened it up, and it just tasted gross.
Yeah, you had some contamination there. With beer, you have to be more careful. Cider, you have to be as well, but you want your hands to be clean. You want anything that comes in the contact with the fermenting liquid to be clean, because you don't want to... What probably happened was some sort of wild yeast or a bacteria got in there and started, because it's sugar. It's sugar and water, and a lot of different organisms love that. So
maybe we'll try it again sometime. It's interesting you bring up the Midwest Supply Company, because I've actually driven past that building and I've always wondered what they were doing there. There's always, you know, people going in and out of the place, because I guess they have a store right there also you can shop at.
Yeah, they have an online store and a in-person brick and mortar. And I've called them with the most knuckleheaded questions, and someone answers the phone. It's not this chat bot, you know, or you're not sent to a country around the world to a, what's that called, where they have a bunch of phone people.
Call center.
Call center. You know, it's just, it's Joe. Hey, it's Joe. How you doing? You know, Midwest Supplies. I like them. So full disclosure, they did send me a beer brewing kit that I'm going to make a video about. It's just kind of spontaneous. I just called them once and said, why don't you send me something? I'll make a video. And so, but they are good guys.
Nice.
So
hey, speaking of videos, you had a video the other day that you posted about mounting things in brick. Did you ever figure out, is it drilling into the brick or drilling into the grout? What was ever the, you know,
you'll have to watch the video, Will. No, you drill into the brick. All right. So if you disagree with me, leave a comment.
I would think drilling into the mortar would be easier, but drilling in the brick would be more secure.
Yes. The problem is that brick is more solid than the mortar. If it's done right, the mortar is quite good, but cement or mortar or masonry, some people yelled at me because I said masonry wrong in the video, which is weird, but the masonry is going to fall apart before the brick does. And if you just need to hang a little thing, you can probably put a screw into the masonry. Like if you need to hang a calendar, a paper 12-year calendar, that would be fine. But if you're going to hang a picture frame with a mirror on it or glass or a shelf or a TV, people put TVs on brick walls, you need to go into the brick.
That same technique is a technique you can use to hang TVs on the wall, because I know that's what a lot of people do, is they have brick walls and they need to hang a TV on there or something like that. So, yeah, it makes sense to mount it into the brick where it'll hold it a lot tighter. I mean, that mortar loosens up a little bit and that thing's coming off the wall.
Right. And if you're going to hang a TV or something heavy, you want what's called sleeved anchors. If you go to your home improvement store and ask for sleeved anchors, they come in different diameters. And you should really use a very new masonry bit that matches the size specified. If you use a different size, they won't grab, because they basically, it's a backwards bolt. The threads with the nuts stick out the front of the brick to hang the item, and the back end that's in the back of the brick the hole you've drilled in the brick mushrooms out, and it has to be just the right diameter for them to work. But if you do put them in, they're fantastic. They're really good. I've made a ton of money installing TVs on brick walls in New York City here, because invariably someone calls and says, well, we tried to do this and we can't. Could you come do it? And then you look at the nightmare that they've tried.
Okay, I do have to ask you one question about that, which I don't think you've covered in a video, but what do you do with the cords for the TV then? Do they just hang down on the front of the brick, or is there some way to run it behind the brick wall and then come out on the bottom? You know, where people like that clean look where the, you know, the TV's on the wall. How do you handle that?
I use a wireless Tesla televisions, you know, just the electricity goes through. No, it's a quandary. What I call it wire mold. It's metal or plastic surface wire conduit, and it comes with a plastic version. The problem is it's this ugly beige color, but it's like a flat, low profile plastic tunnel where you can put all your wires. It snaps open and closed, and I'll paint that the color of the brick. You can spray, or you could paint it black, a flat black, and it'll kind of disappear, but it'll hide the wires. A lot of times you cannot run, by the way, electrical power cords through drywall walls, because I've seen people do that, and that's against code, and that's a bad thing. So yeah, you have to use it's called channel or wire mold, and that's the best you can do.
Gotcha.
But spray paint it black or a dark red. It comes to this kind of beigey color, and I'm like, ugh, you know?
I've seen that. There was some buildings when we were over in Europe doing a lot of stuff. They have a lot of brick that they deal with. And for electrical, they do the same thing. They have this channel that basically runs on the face of the brick, you know, down at, you know, the lower level or whatever it is, because they can't run the wire through the concrete or stone walls. And I'm guessing it's that same material, basically. It's a channel, and then you can have it go to electrical boxes or whatever. Instead, you're just using it to, you know, run the TV wires.
Yeah, I see that a lot here in these older row houses, because it's a plaster wall it's plaster on top of a brick wall, and to try and gouge that out to run BX or Romex or whatever is just a pain. So, and the beauty of this wire mold stuff, the metal kind, you can run it right on top of the base molding, and if you paint it the color of the wall, it kind of disappears visually. And it's very safe. It makes the wiring a lot safer, because in these older buildings, you just find these nightmares and you're like, yikes.
I remember the video that you showed, and I think of this all the time when I think of working in something with a brick wall or anything, where you opened it up and you were doing the plumbing, and there was all of that coax and piping and wire that was all wrapped. I can't remember what the steel wrap is called, but that, like, all just snarled together going up the inside of this. And you kind of made a comment that, yeah, when somebody finds a space in the wall, over the last 100 years, everybody thought it was a good idea to run something through there. And there's, you know, 60 things going through this one wall.
Yeah, that should ideally all be separate. But actually, I was just on the roof of my buddy's house. We all have row houses here in Brooklyn. And originally, all the row houses, somewhere in the center along the side wall, is an air shaft, because all the bathrooms on each floor, even by code back then, had to have a fresh air access. So there's essentially an air shaft going down the building, and each bathroom had a little window that opened up to that air shaft. And then there was a vented skylight at the top of that air shaft. And in a lot of buildings, you've put in, you know, bathroom fans with tubing that goes up to the roof to vent it. That shaft has been capped off, and all the plumbing and electric has run up that shaft now. Or there's a dumbwaiter shaft, which the same thing happens. You no longer need that dumbwaiter, and you just run all your electric and plumbing up that shaft. So. Or they turn it into a closet.
All right. I'm going to ask the question, just because I know somebody's probably asking the same question and speaking to the radio right now. What is a dumbwaiter?
Oh, it's like a little mini freight elevator in your building. I've seen them in brownstones. They're in bigger buildings. My father used to run a dumbwaiter in the South Bronx, because my grandfather was a building super. It can be the size of a milk crate or the size of two or four milk crates. And it runs in a shaft up through the building. And usually there's a cabinet door in the bat in the kitchen of each of the apartments. And I think you can ring a bell in each apartment. But that's how the trash was taken out back in the day, is that they would put the trash in the dumbwaiter, and then the guy down in the basement, usually my father, would lower it back down, and then he'd go up to the next floor. And I think you could ring a bell. It's also how they got, I think how they got coal out of buildings when the individual apartments had little coal fireplaces. They would haul the coal down the dumbwaiter as well. Or deliver groceries, you know?
I'm guessing you could use it also to haul stuff up. I mean, yes. You know, your milk or your groceries or whatever, you put them on the bottom and bring it up through the building.
Right. When you had, you know, full service buildings, that's what that was used for. And I also know that people used to crawl in the dumbwaiter and they would hoist themselves up to a particular apartment. So
easy way. That's the new way to, or the old way to sneak out when you're a teenager, is you take the dumbwaiter down to the lower level and sneak out and have a good time on the town.
Wink, wink.
Nice.
But my father used to do that. He would shovel coal into the boiler in the basement. You know, all the hair was singed off his arms from shoveling coal. And that was hard work. But my grandfather actually was an undocumented immigrant, came to America, and put 4 kids through college. So there you go.
Amazing.
Yeah, now look at me.
Yeah, I was complaining about working the other day. The stapler ran out of staples, and I had to walk all the way to the supply cabinet to get a new box of staples. I mean, I don't know how I'm going to make it through the day.
Yeah, be happy you don't have to shovel coal.
Exactly.
All right. So you posted some pictures on Instagram and Facebook of putting in egress windows into it looked like a basement wall.
Yeah, I would have never thought that would be so confrontational or people would be so concerned about it. But we just to give everybody kind of a little background, we have a 1960s cabin up north, and we did a full remodel a couple years ago on the main level, and this has a full basement underneath it. And we'd replaced or removed a number of the windows in the basement, but there was two of them kind of on the living quarter side that were still there. The problem was is they weren't very safe, weren't very efficient, and we needed to basically update them. And one of the things that you need to do when you're updating a window is make it an egress window. An egress is basically making it an exit that you can get out of in case there's an emergency in the house. So your first form of egress is going upstairs. The second form of egress would be going out the window, which involves digging a hole and putting in the window. And it has to be certain sizes, and there's a window pit and things like that. So that's basically kind of what the project was.
All right. That's what I thought. Yeah, but because egress is kind of a big fire department word or a building code word I found. No one else really uses it, but it means get out of the building.
Yeah, it's basically if you're trapped in the basement and let's say the the stairs has a fire or something like that and you need a second way to get out. In older homes, they used to have those. They were like 12 inches by 24 inch windows, which were, you know, usually way up at the top of the wall, and they were very difficult to get out. A lot of times they would have bars on them so that people wouldn't, you know, break into the house or whatever. And people would be trapped in the basement during a fire or some emergency and they couldn't get out. So the National Fire Protection Agency basically came up with this design of, hey, let's build a – the simple idea is dig a hole that's about 36 by 36 on the outside of the house, so 33 feet by 3 feet. Mm-hmm. And then you make it whatever depth you need to put in your window. They make metal surrounds in all different sizes at the home improvement store. You just pick one up, slide it in, and now you have basically a permanent hole on the outside of your house. Then you just cut a hole through the wall, install a window like you'd normally install a window in the side of the house. And when you're standing in there, you're looking out at this hole. Well, now you just have to step up, let's say, 3 feet into the hole and then step out of the hole and out instead of going through that little tiny window that's probably, you know, barred up and up at the top that you probably couldn't squeeze through anyways.
Right. Or rusted shut. I run into that a lot.
Yep. So we had to rent a concrete saw, which that has a story all of its own. Those saws make a huge mess, and no matter how much you try to mitigate the dust getting in your house, unfortunately, I fogged the entire upstairs with dust, so we're going to have to do a lot of dusting when it all finally settles.
Oh, wow.
Well, because you run the saw and you put up plastic, and I think I put it in one of the Instagram stories or something. My buddy Matt was running the saw in one of the windows, and I did the other one, and we had the plastic up. Well, the dust was going up over the joist into the other space and then ending up in the cold air return, and then it just kind of worked its way through the house. But once you cut through the concrete wall, take out the block, put in a wood frame, and slap in the window, and it's just like installing a window on the upper part of your house.
Nice. Did you use any particular special sealant to seal the window against the outside for keeping cold air out? Or?
Well, there's a building material. I think it's like PL400, I think is what it's called, or something along those lines. Basically, there's a wood to brick sealant. So you put that around the outside of it. Then you put pressure treated wood against the block to make sure that it doesn't rot. And that basically builds the initial box. Then when you put in the window, there's a gasket that you put around the outside between the wood and the window, install it with the nailing flange, which is the little holes around the outside of a window to mount it to the building. And then you just flash it like you'd normally flash a window on the outside of your house.
PL is a brand of glue, kind of like liquid nails. It comes in a caulk form. And PL400, they're all polyurethane glues, but they're kind of amazing. They can be used on roofs. They can be used for cement. They can be used for wood. So they have very specific ones. And then they have a couple of all-purpose glues. But they're a good product.
Yeah. The window itself, the frame, once you put it in, we use something called Tapcons. I don't know if you've talked about those before. Basically, it comes with its own drill bit when you buy a pack of them. We drilled the holes through the wood and into the block. And then you just put this Tapcon screw. It's a blue screw that anchors it in. So that thing's not going anywhere. But the nice thing is, I mean, the amount of light that we went from the little, 12 by 24 window to now I have a 32 by 48 window in the basement wall. I mean, it completely transformed that side of the basement. So, the living space that we have over there is going to be much, much nicer.
All right. Let me just hold on a minute. I think I might have a little technical glitch here. So
fire away.
Okay. The recording software is acting weird, so I just restarted it. So we'll see what happens.
Gotcha. We didn't lose all the great stuff that we just talked about, did we?
We might have.
I always think of like the Joe Rogan podcast where they talk for like 3 hours, and what happens if that thing shuts off in the middle and you lose all the good stuff that Elon Musk has to say or something like that?
He probably has a second device,
Yeah,
they true. Probably have a backup recorder, so... But anyway,
do you ever listen to his show?
No, it's on the list to do, but I have not yet. So
if you get a chance, listen to the Elon Musk one. It was actually a really good show. He talked about kind of all how Tesla started and how he gets into the different things and just kind of the way he thinks. It's interesting. Little course on the language, just as a warning to anyone who's listening as a family. But
hey, real quick here, I was wondering if you wanted to join the Garden Fork email list. It's Maura Eric. I don't know if you want that or not. But the best way to do that, if you go to the gardenfork.tv site, there are signups all over the place. There should be one on every page. Also, in the show notes for this show, if you're listening to it in the iTunes app or one of the other podcast app, to click on the little, I think you click on the little text thumbnail of the show and the notes will pop up and there's a link in there, or just go to gardenfork.tv and there should be a sign up there. All right. Thank you. All right. So next on our list, it says fall stuff.
You know, it's fall outside right now, right?
Yeah, I know. The temperature dropped really quick here and I'm not ready.
I'm not ready. It actually snowed at the property on Sunday. We had an inch and a half of snow in the yard. I'm like, I don't even have any of my equipment turned over. You know how like you'll put stable in the gas. And I mean, I still have water in my pressure washer right now. So hopefully it didn't freeze up.
Sorry, I had to take a mint tea break there. Yeah, for those of you who have power equipment that are run by gasoline engines, please use gas stabilizer. I don't care which brand. People argue about which brand. The blue stuff versus the red stuff. It all does a pretty good job. I run it summer and winter. That way I can't forget. And also it will prolong the carburetor. If you put regular unleaded gas that has ethanol in it in your small engines, it will slowly ruin the carburetor, in my opinion. There are some states where you can buy gas that doesn't have ethanol in it, but on the East Coast, I don't think that exists. So can you get ethanol-free gas up there? Or?
Actually, if you're familiar with the numbering system, you know how you have like 87 and then 90 or 89 and then 93 or 94 gas.
Right.
Usually your 93 and 94 high octane gas is actually ethanol free. If you look at the little tag, it'll say on there, depending on where you are, you might think, oh, we don't have non-ox gas. But in all reality, the high octane gas, the expensive stuff, actually is non-ox.
Oh, I'll have to look at that.
Didn't know if you knew that.
Well, I always learn something with you. That's why you're on the show. And also because you're very persistent.
7 emails later, here we are. I will say this, though, if we're talking about fall power equipment, one thing to do, and this is a little trick that somebody at one of the machine shops told me, is take your spark plug and back it out. And the same company that makes the stable for the gas, they make something called fogging oil. And he said, just back your spark plug out, spray some fogging oil into the cylinder, and then give the cord a slight pull so you can hear it kind of running, but don't like jerk it really fast. Just give it a slow pull so it kind of cycles a little bit, then put that spark plug back in. And what it does is it coats the cylinder and the pistons inside of the engine so that if any moisture of any kind is in there, you don't get any rust or any like rough spots or anything like that, and it'll make your engine run a lot smoother when you need to use it the next season.
That's great. There's a YouTube channel called Donny Boy, Donyboy, I think 73 he puts at the end, but Donny Boy, he's Canadian, Donyboy, just type that in. He's got great videos on small engine maintenance and just like this thing, you know, the guy brought in a lawnmower and it was running rough and he shows how he diagnoses it and he finds that the coil is bad or that the carburetor is bad or the little fuel pump is bad or a hose is missing and I've learned a lot. It's kind of neat. So, and he talks about fuel additives and stuff every once in a while as well. But I don't know. I like watching some guy take apart a chainsaw.
Well, I think one thing for people is they look at their small equipment, you know, their chainsaws, their leaf blowers, their lawnmowers, and it's onerous. They don't know where to start, what to do or anything like that. And, you know, in all reality, there's only a couple things you do. I usually will take the air filter out and blow out any dust out of it, you know, with one of those cans of compressed air or your air compressor, and then put a little fogging oil in the thing and put the stable in the gas. And I mean, just by doing those couple steps, it's much better than just leaving it in the shed and hoping it'll run next year.
Yeah. A friend of mine was given a Husqvarna chainsaw, an 18-inch. It was a really nice machine, you know, and it looked almost brand new. And he goes, yeah, it's been sitting around for years. They never used it. And they gave it to me. And he goes, I can't get it started. I'm like, well, give it to me. You know, so we were in his yard cutting some stuff. And I bring a milk crate full of chainsaw stuff when I ever go anywhere. And I drained out. I have a turkey baster. It looks like a giant eyedropper, you know.
Yep.
And I sucked out all the old gas out of the gas tank. And I put in new gas. I pulled the spark plug out because you have the chain tensioner tool is also a spark plug wrench. And it was a little corroded, so I cleaned that back up. And I popped that in, put fresh oil in it. And like on the third pull, it started right up.
It's amazing how that happens. Like I've seen people, there was a bunch of people on YouTube, I can't think of the channel name, where they go out to yard sales and they buy equipment that's not running, or they'll go pick up equipment like that. And then a couple simple things and boom, they have a running device. So instead of spending $150 or $200 for a chainsaw, they buy one for $40 on a yard sale or Craigslist, spend a little bit of time doing that kind of stuff. And now they have working equipment, and it's an easy, cheap way to get, you know, power equipment for your house.
Yeah. Donny Boy, said the other day he had to replace a carburetor on a chainsaw. And he said, you know, I could rebuild this carburetor, but if it fails again, the customer is going to come back and say what you did didn't work. He goes, so now I just replace the whole carburetor. And they're not that expensive. That actually for Husqvarnas, there are third-party clone carburetors that seem to work fairly well. I don't know about Steel, but I know for Briggs & Stratton, I buy the original Briggs & Stratton carburetors, but you can buy clones as well. But it's to take apart a carb and get the jets out and the little O-rings and everything and clean them and put them back in and get it done correctly is kind of a roll of the dice. So I'm big on just replacing the carburetor and it's done.
Have you ever had any luck with those third parties? Because I see them and they're significantly cheaper than the OEM or the original manufacturer product. But I always get nervous because, like, if you're going to go through all the work of trying to do some maintenance on the machine, I kind of feel like buying the first party equipment is always better just because then, you know, you don't have to go back and do it again. I guess, have you ever run into any of that stuff that does work really well?
On the Briggs & Stratton, they work okay. I'm going to do one on a friend's Husqvarna, and he has to order the carb, and we're going to see what happens. I think it'll be an interesting experiment. On Amazon, there's a bunch of third-party carbs, and I looked at the reviews of them, and I learned a lot, because like one company selling them, they're like, the comments were, the fuel line hose supplied is not nearly long enough. And then the other one is like, oh, perfect fit, it worked great, easy. I'm like, okay, I'll buy that one. So I do find the reviews very helpful. So we'll see. Maybe there's a video in this whole thing. Who knows?
I have a generator that currently the pin on the bottom of it is sticking. So if you leave it sit long enough, it'll drain all the gas out of the generator, which is not very good.
No.
And I have to replace it. It's on a Honda, and I've been looking at it, and wow, the parts for that thing are very expensive. I mean, I get it that they last forever, but wow, I was pretty shocked. So I was tempted to buy the third-party piece, but I haven't pulled the trigger yet.
On the Honda, I would buy the original. Those are just, they're excellent machines, and if you replace like with like, and that's something that you need to have work, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is our back. We have the generator for the house. This is kind of the small portable one where if you're taking it around to do projects and things like that. So it's not mission critical, but it is nice to have, especially if you have to run the table saw or some equipment out in the woods or whatever.
In the film world of New York, I'll let you behind the curtain here, Will. Those kind of little generators are called putt-putt generators.
Nice. Nice. Now we got a cool name for it.
I don't know where that name came from, but...
I'm guessing it's probably how it sounds or something like that, because those smaller ones have a little bit different sound than the big ones.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. But they're, you know, if you just have to run one light or you have to power, like the coffee maker at the craft service table, a lot of times they bring out one of those little putt-putts and fire it up.
So let's continue down this rabbit hole just one more step. I have one more question for you, because I know that you shop at Harbor Freight. Have you ever considered or looked at the, I think it's called a Predator generator from Harbor Freight? They're supposed to be the equivalent of a Honda, you know, 1000 or 2000, you know, the kind of the gold standard of quiet generators. Yeah. Have you ever experienced those, or what are your thoughts on those?
I'm intrigued, but I have seen some comments where the carb has gone out and they can't figure out how to buy a carb for it. I mean, maybe you can call Harbor Freight and see. I mean, Harbor Freight might sell them. So I'm not sure.
I'm just curious because it's amazing the price difference between like a Honda and that. And this is not an endorsement for either of those brands either. It's just a curiosity because at some point this small generator I'm going to have to replace. And I was looking at the new ones and I was kind of sticker shock a little bit on what a new one is. And then I went to Harbor Freight and I happened to see them and I saw a lot of good reviews about them, but I didn't know if anybody's actually ever used them.
Well, if anyone has this listening, it's radio@gardenfork.tv. I'd be curious as well. I do have a Harbor Freight flux core welder and it works just fine, but if it breaks, the generator, it's kind of a different story. So
I'll go in the Facebook group and I'll post this question, and if you're listening to the podcast, just go over there and maybe leave a comment also.
Yeah,
you know, check the group out.
We'll link to the group in the show notes here, but if you go to Facebook and just type in Garden Fork discussion group, it should show up. And we ask, you have to request to join. That's how we keep the spammers out. And there's a couple of questions. And if you don't answer a question, you don't get in.
How did Rick and I get in there then? Just curious.
Because I'm just nice.
No, sorry, Rick.
You guys do all the work. I go on there and I just hit the like button a lot.
Well, Rick and I were the ones who were debating back and forth regarding the egress window, because his concern, and he has a valid one, which is you just put a giant window in your tornado shelter. And you know, so we started going back and forth regarding that. But, you know, there's a lot of good information that people share back and forth, and it's pretty good. It stimulates the conversation, and you end up, as a person who's just looking at it, you get to learn a lot of different things, which is cool.
Yeah, yeah. There's also the Garden Fork email newsletter, which you should all have. If you go to the gardenfork.tv site, there's a sign up, should be right on the screen there somewhere. or you can go to send an email to news@gardenfork.tv. That's news@gardenfork.tv. You'll get our autoresponse with a link and a sign up right there. So there you go. Wow. So we had a little technical glitch. So I don't know if we've been talking for 12 minutes or 25 minutes.
It's either a really short podcast or a really long podcast.
Yeah. Is there anything else we have to touch on here? Oh, So Will texts me, he goes, there's 100 people coming to my camp this weekend. And I'm like, what?
Yeah, once a year. I know you sent me back. You're like, you are very brave, I think is what you sent back. But once a year in the fall, myself and a couple of other YouTubers in the upper Midwest host an event, and we just happen to do it on our property. And we call it the Homestead Fall Festival. And basically, people show up. And like last year, we had somebody show up who had an apple grinder and a press, and we made apple cider as a class. And basically, we open it up. People can camp out on the property. And this year we had just under 100 people show up, and it's a big potluck and outdoors and ATV rides and different, you know, like seminars, like people sit down and talk about how to make soap or how to do different things. And it's just kind of a fun get together. And yeah, I just put it out online that anybody can show up, and they do.
That's amazing. It's also kind of gives you hope for our country where, people are just willing to meet maybe people they don't know but have a common interest, and everyone gets along pretty much.
Yeah, we kick the event off with a couple icebreakers. Like we have a sheet where, you know, hey, go find somebody who has solar, and go find somebody who has chickens on their farm, or go find somebody who has a DIY project or something like that. And everybody kind of mingles and gets to know each other. And then, you know, there's areas around the campfire where some people were doing songs this year. And it was kind of a colder event this year, but it's a lot of fun. We, you know, started about 11 o'clock in the morning, and then it usually ends with a fireworks show at the end around 7 o'clock, and the campers stick around. And you know, if anybody's around in the upper Midwest in the fall, it's usually one of the last weekends in September.
Wow, good for you. I could not do that. I'm good for about 5 minutes, and then I just want to shrink away.
Well, for me, I mean, basically, I mowed the lawn, popped up a tent, you know, swept off the driveway, and people just showed up. And it's nice. The coolest part about it was everybody was willing to chip in and brought different things. Like on the invite, they'd be like, hey, I have a casserole that I want to make and do for the potluck. Or, you know, like the gentleman who brought the apple press. He's like, hey, I own an apple farm or whatever, and we're going to bring a couple crates of apples and a press, and we're going to make cider right there and show people. And he had the grinder and everything. And it was cool that people just kind of volunteer because they want to show what they do. And that's what made the community really great.
Yay. All right, cool. So I think that'll do it for our show here. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for listening, everyone. Radio@gardenfork.tv is the best way to get a hold of us. There'll be some viewer mail I read next time. And Will, thanks for taking the time.
Of course. Thanks for having me on.
All right, make it a great day, everyone. We will see you. Garden Fork Radio's executive producer is Jimmy Gutz of hollowbooks.com. And our music is licensed from uniquetracks.com.